Last Lord's Day, we really directed our studies to the Lord's table. We connected our study really of Jude to our observance of the Lord's table. And we did this by being reminded of the fact that when we look at these apostates, we see that these are blind men who are filled with rebellion and filled with impiety. That is clearly evident throughout the epistle of Jude. They're blind, rebellious, and impious. And so we really took the study in a personal way and considered the fact that only by the shed blood of Christ that our blindness has been turned to sight, our rebellion to submission, and our impiety to piety. This is the contrasting study that we approached last week, and the reason why we're doing this is because insofar as we're studying and examining these apostates, we must remember, as we've said many times, that apart, if it were not for the grace of God, we too would be in the same state of darkness and rebellion and impiety. Again, I believe this is crucial. I think that if we do not keep this kind of thinking, this kind of biblical thinking in view, then we will enter in, I think, into the potential danger of thinking that somehow we're better than these apostates by nature, and we're not by nature anyway, not by our own fallen nature. Only the grace of God can draw us away from such blindness, rebellion, and impiety. You know, I think that it therefore leads us to conclude that the only thing that we have to boast in is in our Lord Jesus Christ. And that's the key point that we really came to last time and want to continue as we study through this epistle. The other thing that we are reminded of is the fact that Jude, in describing these apostates, that he is really helping us to understand that that these men, in a very crafty way, introduce themselves into the church and introduce the destructive teaching of transforming the grace of God into licentiousness. And this reminds us of the fact that Satan is always very coy and very clever in the manner in which he introduces false teaching into the church. We've said it several times before that Satan does not enter into the church announcing himself as an enemy of the gospel. No, he comes as an angel of light. He comes as if a friend to the truth. And he is very, very well suited in this form of deception. I'm mindful of William Jenkins' thought on this. This is a 17th century Puritan who was a blessed, ejected pastor. He was a nonconformist preacher and pastor who was ejected because of his unwillingness to submit himself to the mandates of the Church of England. He said this about the devil. He says, quote, "The devil shapes himself to the fashions of all men. If he meets a proud man or a prodigal man, then he makes himself a flatterer. If a covetous man, then he comes with a reward in his hand. He hath an apple for Eve, a grape for Noah, a change of raiment for Gehazi, a bag for Judas. He can dish out his meat for all palates. He hath a last to fit every shoe. And he hath something to please all conditions." Well stated, and this is the problem that we have here with respect to these apostates. These men came into the church, and they came in with a great deception, with all their apostasy and all their false teaching. They came in with some measure of temptation and some measure of cover, such that they were cloaked with false religion, and yet through their cloak and through their deception, they were able to creep in unnoticed. And yet, what they offered was not the true gospel, but it was a cleverly disguised lie. It was the apple for Eve and the grape for Noah, as he says. And this is the very thing that we're being warned about as we go through Jude, that we need to understand that it is imperative, it is the imperative of the church, the responsibility of the church, to understand and see and know what apostasy looks like. We have to be discerning in these matters. We have to be careful. We have to understand that Satan is always looking for a way into the church in order to corrupt it and its teaching. And the thing we have to understand is that though churches sometimes miss the obvious introduction of false teachers into the church, what we must understand and remember is that God misses nothing. And so this is really the lesson that we came to as we were entering into the verses that we studied last time. In verses 5 through 7, Jude is now reminding us of this very important truth about God and His nature. He's helping us to understand that God misses nothing, and He judges those who are unbelievers. So, he said, in beginning in verse 5, he says, "Now I desire to remind you, though you know all things once for all, that the Lord, after saving a people out of the land of Egypt, subsequently destroyed those who did not believe, and angels who did not keep their own domain, but abandoned their proper abode. He has kept in eternal bonds under darkness for the judgment of the great day. Just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, since they in the same way as these indulged in gross immorality and went after strange flesh, are exhibited as an example in undergoing the punishment of eternal fire." Now, let me make a introductory statement about the verse that we're going to be studying and focusing on, not just this morning, but next Lord's Day as well. Verse 6 is a small verse, but let me tell you this. This verse is actually quite large in terms of the controversy that surrounds it and the questions that really arise in view of what is taught, not just in this verse, but really as this verse is presented in the whole of Jude's epistle. And I'm just going to say this now, that verse 6, it is complex. There's really a great deal of writing that has been done on this verse and other verses related to it. There are questions, I believe, that are raised by this verse about the angels that are spoken of here. And I'm going to promise you this morning that we're going to address some of these things. We're not going to get to all these questions this morning. We're really just going to step into verse 6. We're going to begin our study of verse 6. But what I am telling you is that we're going to come back to this verse. We're going to have to come back to this verse in order to answer some of the controversial questions that are raised because of the teachings that are presented in verse 6. So we're going to save a lot of that controversial matter and study for next Lord's Day. But again, I just say to you that verse 6 raises an abundance of questions about who these angels are. He says this in verse 6. He says, "And angels who did not keep their own domain, but abandoned their proper abode, he has kept in eternal bonds under darkness for the judgment of the great day." Now, saving the controversial matter for next week, the things I want us to glean from this verse are as follows. And we're just going to follow the grammar and structure of the verse in order to answer three questions. Number one, what is the nature of their rebellion? What is the nature of the rebellion of these angels? In what sense did they rebel, and how can we say that they were, in a sense, guilty of rebellion? I believe that the language is very clear. What Jude gives us in this verse is, I think, abundantly clear in terms of the nature of their rebellion, and we need to consider what Jude has to say about that rebellion. Secondly, we're going to consider the consequences of their rebellion. The consequences of their rebellion. What happened to these angels who rebelled and therefore did not keep their proper abode, their own domain, as he says? Well, Jude tells us that God has kept them in eternal bonds under darkness for the judgment of the great day. There's a lot in that statement, and there are many questions that arise again from what is said there, but we need to think about what we can learn from this verse about the consequences that these angels faced in view of their rebellion. That's our second point. Our third point and study will really be to back up and just ask the question, what is the major lesson that we learn from their rebellion? These angels who rebelled, what is the lesson of their rebellion? So that's really kind of our big picture moment. I want us to back up and think about what it is that Jude wants us to glean and understand and learn from verse 6 about the big lesson that we should learn about the rebellion of these angels. Considering the nature of their rebellion, the consequences of their rebellion, and the lesson that we glean from their rebellion, let's think about all that this verse 6, has to offer us here, and let's go through these layers of truth. So, first of all, let's think about the source of their rebellion. The source of their rebellion. How did these angels rebel? How did they fall from heaven? It says, Jude says, "...and angels who did not keep their own domain, but abandoned their proper abode." They did not keep their own domain, but abandoned their proper abode. Let's think about that first statement, about how it is that they did not keep their own domain. This word for domain comes from the Greek word arkane, which could be translated as place of origin. Their place of origin. Well, the question would have to be raised then, what is the place of origin of the angels? Well, their place of origin is heaven. God created them and to abide in His presence and to declare His glory and to reveal His glory and to be witnesses, really, to His great and marvelous works. We read about this, for example, in Job chapter 38, and this is really the first indication that helps us to understand when the angels existed. They were not created after the creation of the heavens and the earth, but they actually existed before the creation of the heavens and the earth. And this is alluded to in Job 38, verses 1 through 7, where it says that the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now gird up your loins like a man, and I will ask you, and you instruct me." God is being sardonic here. "Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth?" By the way, what's the answer to that question? Job wasn't around at all, right? "Tell me if you have understanding." Verse 5, "Who set its measurements, since you know, or who stretched the line on it? On what were these bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars," listen to this, "when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy." And it's that last verse, verse 7, where we see the reference to the morning stars singing together, and then there's the reference of the Bene Elohim, the sons of God, they shouted for joy. Now, in the Old Testament scriptures, we have multiple references to the Bene Elim or the Bene Elohim, the sons of God. And these are typically references to angels that God has created. It's another reference to or mention of, or another name for the angels whom God created. And it says here in verse 7 that the angels whom God created, being referred to as stars, that they sang together in joy at the sight of God's creation. Okay? Now, so this helps us to think about the fact that the angels were created before the creation of the heavens and the earth. They were there to witness God's act of the creation of the heavens and the earth. We also know, as we consult the book of Revelation, Revelation chapter 12, that it would appear that a third of those angels were swept away from heaven and fell to the earth when Satan fell. By the way, let me say this. The Old Testament and the New Testament give us somewhat veiled references to the activities of the angels. There are many things that I think are still mysterious about the angels. And some of the Bible verses that instruct us and inform us about the nature of the angels and the nature of the fall of Satan and those angels who fell with him, some of these verses are not terribly clear. They tend to teach us and instruct us implicitly rather than explicitly. But I do believe that this is a reference in Revelation chapter 12 to Satan falling, Satan who is called the red dragon, and it says that his tail swept away a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. Stars being again a reference to the angels of heaven. Most commentators agree that this is really a reference to that, to Satan's fall and the angels who fell with him. So, as we put these pieces together, what we learn is that Satan fell and that a number of angels fell with him, and such that they lost their proper domain, their own domain, being fallen from heaven and being cast to the earth in that sense. And so, Jude says that the angels, they did not keep their own domain, but then he says, but abandoned their proper abode. Their proper abode, or their own abode. And here, the word abode really comes from the root word, oikos, home. It's this idea of their own home, which is, again, as we've already established, it is heaven. And so, with Satan, the angels, in the original account of the fall of Satan, we see that Satan himself and a number of angels fell with him. Now, the other texts that give us an indication about the nature of Satan's fall and the angels who fell with him are found in Ezekiel chapter 28 and Isaiah chapter 14. And I'm not going to take all the time to go through every detail of these texts, but in both of these texts, we have very interesting language that's being presented about the nature of Satan's fall. And I would submit to you that in these passages, you have two things going on. You have God speaking to and addressing kings who existed in the day of the writing of Ezekiel and the writing of Isaiah, kings who existed in those days, but these were kings who I believe were demon-possessed or possessed by Satan, such that God was able to speak to these kings, but ultimately addressing the very one who was driving them, and that was Satan himself. Remember when Jesus approaches the demoniacs and the demon-possessed in the Gospels, who does he speak to? Does he speak to the demoniac? Does he speak to the individual? Or does he speak to the demons directly? Well, it's the latter. He speaks to the demons through the individual himself. And so he addresses the demonic reality, the demonic forces that possess that individual. Well, I believe that's exactly what you have in Ezekiel chapter 28 and Isaiah 14. God speaks not to the king directly, but ultimately to Satan, who is possessing these kings. I think the most explicit example of this is Ezekiel 28. Where it says, and God was speaking there to the king of Tyre, and he says this, and he uses language that could only apply to Satan ultimately. Why? Because in verse 13, back in verse 12, he says, "You had the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty." And mark verse 13, he says, "You were in Eden, the garden of God." Now, Eden, the garden of God, that can only apply in this case to Satan, not to the king of Tyre. And this is why I believe it's very clear that God is speaking to the possessing force that was controlling the king of Tyre, and that is Satan himself. And so it goes on. It says, "Every precious stone was your covering, the ruby, the topaz, and the diamond, the beryl, and the onyx, and the jasper, and the lapis lazuli, and the turquoise, and the emerald, and the gold. The workmanship of your settings and sockets was in you. On that day you were created, they were prepared. You were the anointed cherub who covers. And I placed you there. You were the holy mountain of God. You walked in the midst of the stones of fire. You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created until unrighteousness was found in you." No man is blameless from his day of origin. We are all born in sin. And so I don't believe he's speaking to the king of Tyre, but he's speaking to Satan, who is possessing him. Satan, Lucifer, who was blameless in his day of creation. Then he goes on in verse 16, "By the abundance of your trade, you were internally filled with violence, and you sinned. Therefore I have cast you as profane from the mountain of God, and I have destroyed you, O covering cherub." Again, the cherubim is a reference to angels. "From the midst of the stones of fire. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom by reason of your splendor." And it points to this idea of Lucifer falling from glory from heaven because he adored himself and worshipped himself and desired to be like the Most High. Now that same kind of idea is found also in Isaiah chapter 14, where there God rebukes Satan as he rebukes the king of Babylon, and he says to him, ultimately Satan, in Isaiah 14 and verse 12, he says, "How you have fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn. You have been cut down to the earth. You have weakened the nations, but you said in your heart, 'I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God, and I will sit on the mount of assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High.'" We look at Lucifer's fall and we must understand that he fell because of his pride. Rather than worshiping God, which was the very purpose for which he was created, he worshiped himself. And in that moment, he fell from heaven. And I believe that this is exactly what is being spoken of when it speaks of the red dragon, whose tail sweeps away a third of the stars from heaven and threw them down to the earth. Satan fell and he took a number of angels with him, but they did not fall as victims. They went with him willingly. They went with him willingly. Why do I say that? Well, because the participles that Jude uses speak of active and indicative action on their own part. He says it this way, the angels who did not keep their own domain. They themselves, in other words, did not keep their own domain. Then he says, but they abandoned their proper abode. Again, another indication of their own indicative actions. D. Edmund Hebert, in his commentary on Jude, speaks of the active voice of the two participles that are in these two phrases, where it says, the angels who did not keep their own domain but abandoned their own proper abode. He says this, and I quote, "Their failure was not due to external compulsion, but involved a deliberate decision not to maintain their own principality. Positively or actively, these angels sinned in that they left their proper habitation," Jude says. But he, that is Jude, does not say why. We know about Satan, we know about Lucifer. We might surmise, perhaps, that the angels also fell with him because of the same sin of pride and arrogance. But I have to say, we have to come up to the point where when the Scriptures do not speak to an issue, we just have to say, we don't know. And that's okay. What we don't want to do is make things up or fill in the blank spaces and try to impose our own ideas. It's somewhat mysterious. We might surmise or at least suggest that it's a possibility that they fell in the same likeness and image of Lucifer's fall. But again, to some certain extent, we have to call this mysterious insofar as it is not exactly identified or clarified in the Scriptures. Now, let me say this. As soon as we come to this very subject of the fall of Lucifer, the fall of the angels, even the fall of man, we're really entering into a discussion that I believe is somewhat complex. It's something that transcends human understanding and thinking to some extent. Why is there sin in the world at all? Well, we certainly understand that God in His providence allowed for or permitted the introduction of sin into the world. Paul talks about this in Romans chapter 9 and talks about the overarching purposes of God so as to display His power and His mercy in the judgment of the wicked and the salvation of those who are His. Jonathan Edwards, I think, gives us a helpful illustration to think about how it is that a holy God permits or allows for sin to take place in the world. And I'm going to borrow an object here. I hope this is okay. Is this somebody's sacred object here? Okay. I'm going to use that in just a moment. Jonathan Edwards, in his book, The Dissertation of the Freedom of the Will, and if you don't have it, I'd say get it and read it. It's very good. Excellent. He uses, he talks of this issue of the introduction of sin into the world, and he really talks about the fact that on the one hand this is somewhat mysterious, but also we can at least try to comprehend God's providence over these things. He says it this way. He says, "It is certain and demonstrable from the Holy Scriptures, as well as the nature of things, that God permits sin." And the word permit is very important, because to say that God commits sin would be a very problematic thing. God is holy. He does not commit sin. He does not dwell in the presence of evil. He hates and loathes it, but he does allow it to take place for his sovereign purposes. And so that word permit is very important. He then goes on and he says, "And at the same time, so orders things in his providence that it certainly and infallibly will come to pass in consequence of his permission." Then, drawing from an illustration from nature, he says, "As there is a vast difference between the sun's being the cause of the lightsomeness and warmth of the atmosphere and brightness of gold and diamonds by its presence and positive influence, and its being the occasion of darkness and frost in the night by its motion whereby it descends below the horizon." And then he says, "Whereby if cold and darkness are found to be the consequence of its withdrawment, the more strongly does it argue the sun to be the fountain of light and heat, rather than being the positive active source of darkness and cold. So inasmuch as sin is not the fruit of any positive agency or influence of the Most High, but on the contrary arises from the withholding of his action and energy, and under certain circumstances necessarily follows on the want of his influence." Very simply, all that he's saying is this: the sun produces heat and light. Its absence is what produces the consequence of darkness and frost. And what he's saying is that all you need in order to have a creature fall from grace is the removal of God's active grace or influence. And so the removal of the sunlight and the sunbeams from the earth produces darkness and frost. That's a natural consequence. Being a physicist, I like using gravity as my illustration and saying, as I've done with my kids many times, what do I need to do to make this go to the ground? I don't have to throw it actively in terms of forcing it down. All that I have to do is let go. And it meets the earth. By the very nature of the relationship of the earth via gravity to that object, it falls on its own. It's somewhat of a mystery on the one hand, and our limited human thinking is limited, but the thing that we have to understand is that God, in his sovereignty, permitted and allowed for the fall of the angels. But one thing we must understand, and by the language of Jude, in Jude 6, these angels were not victims in any way. They fell of their own accord and volition. And the active nature of these participles really speaks to that issue. Now, in stating these matters and just asking the question, what is the nature of their fall? Well, the nature of their fall is that they themselves fell. Okay, they are the source of their own fall. They produce their own rebellion against God and the very domain that they existed in heaven. But questions arise from this verse. Are the fallen angels of Jude 6 equal to those who fell with Lucifer? In other words, are these the very angels who were swept away when Satan himself fell from heaven, when Lucifer himself fell from heaven? Well, we need to press on in our study of this verse to investigate that question further. Jude says, "The angels who did not keep their own domain but abandoned their own proper abode, he has kept in eternal bonds under darkness for the judgment of the great day." Now, mark the words, "he has kept." This is what is called the heart of the clause, the main sentence here in verse 6. In other words, everything that is said here in verse 6 wraps itself around this primary clause. He has kept. He has kept whom? The angels. He has kept them where? Well, he's kept them in eternal bonds. He's kept them under darkness, and he has kept them for the judgment of the great day. And so you have really three ways in which this idea of God keeping them for judgment, you have three ways in which this is modified. We have three prepositions that modify the manner in which God keeps these angels. He keeps them in eternal bonds. He keeps them under darkness, and he keeps them for the judgment of the great day. I want us to layer our way through all of those, and I want us to do it in the order of the Greek. Because Jude puts in the emphatic position the great day of judgment. That's actually at the beginning rather than at the end, and the translators put it at the end, but really it should be at the beginning. You would really translate it as he has kept for the great judgment, for the great day of judgment, he has kept them in eternal bonds under darkness. That would be the proper order. So let's think about that order in the Greek. That it is the fact that God keeps them unto judgment, the great day of judgment. Hebert observes this concerning this very matter. He says, the exact expression does not occur elsewhere in the New Testament, but it has parallels in the wording of Revelation 6:17 and 6:14. It is a unique expression by itself, but I think it's clearly pointing to the final judgment of God. That's why it's called the great day of judgment, the great day of judgment. Similar language we have in Revelation 6:17 and 16:14. The Gospel of John speaks of it as the last day. The angel flying in mid-heaven announces that the hour of his judgment, his chrysaos, is come. It's this idea of the final coming judgment of God, the great judgment of God, whereby his judgment is final and the souls of mankind and even the angels are adjudicated in the final day, in the final judgment. And this is the day that is coming that even the demons know is coming. Remember that when Jesus came to the country of the Gadarenes, two men were demon-possessed, and they met him as he was coming out of the tombs. And they were so extremely violent that no one could pass by that way. Matthew 8 and verse 29 then says, and they cried out, saying, what business do we have with each other, Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time? This reveals the fact that the demons know that there's a coming day, a great day of judgment, where they will be judged and tormented. They know about this day. And the very day then that Jude is speaking of is a day that the demons themselves know about, these fallen angels. So they're kept for judgment, this great day of judgment. How are they kept? Well, they're kept in, it says, in eternal bonds. Not just bonds of any kind, but they are eternal bonds. This really speaks of a very demonstrative bondage and imprisonment. And so the word that he uses here, Tereken, is a perfect active indicative verb. God is keeping or has kept them and continues to keep them in this bondage, and the bonds that they bear are eternal bonds. This really speaks of the permanency of their being in bondage and their being imprisoned. In other words, there's no sense in which they're going to be pardoned or released at any time, is the idea. And they are kept, and this is the third modifying phrase, they are kept under darkness. They're kept in eternal bonds, but under darkness. And this expression, hupozophon, speaks of not just material darkness, the absence of light, but it speaks of this idea of gloom or sorrow. This idea of gloom or sorrow, one lexicon says it this way, it is a condition of darkness associated with feelings of despair and foreboding. In other words, it's a darkness that provokes sorrow and even fear, as one other writer mentions. So this word zophon is really very emotive in nature. We're not just talking about the absence of light, but there's a very great sorrow and fear that comes with the presence of such darkness. Now, this is all very interesting, because when you really think about the implications of what we're reading here, and what I'm doing is I'm voicing the thoughts and ideas of many commentators here when I say this, there are questions that come up and arise from the language of this verse that then lead us to ask the question, who are these angels? Because these angels are said to be bound, imprisoned, constrained, not allowed to roam about and afflict others and demon-possess others and so forth. Hebert says this, again in his commentary, he says, because they are bound, these angels must be distinguished from other fallen angels who are now unbound and active against mankind. And he references Luke chapter 8, where the Lord was in the country of the Gerasenes, and he came out unto the land, it says, and he was met by a man from the city who was possessed with demons, and who had not put on any clothing for a long time, and was not living in a house, but in the tombs. So, seeing Jesus, he cried out and fell before him and said in a loud voice, "What business do we have with each other, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." For he had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man, for it had seized him many times, and he was bound with chains and shackles and kept under guard, and yet he would break his bonds and be driven by the demon into the desert. And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Legion," for many demons had entered him, and they were imploring him not to command them to go away into the abyss. And that's a reference to permanent imprisonment and bondage in darkness. Hebert's point, and the point of many other commentators as they raise questions about this verse, is, again, who are these demons in Jude 6? Because the demons, the fallen angels, the demons who afflict men, who wander about the earth, who fill the earth and plague mankind with their wickedness and their influences, those are different than those, by appearance anyway, they seem to be different than the class of demons or fallen angels mentioned in verse 6, who are bound and constrained. They're not roaming about, it would seem, by the language here. And so this really brings us to some of the complexity and difficulty of Jude 6. Are these angels associated with Satan's fall before the creation, or did these angels fall after the creation but before the deluge, sometime really leading up to the deluge, but just before the deluge, whereby God delivered Noah through the flood? Now, why are we bringing this up? Well, we bring it up because, as we've already mentioned time and again before, is that 2 Peter is really a parallel text to Jude. And because Peter mentions the flood in conjunction with fallen angels, some have surmised and have argued that these demons, these fallen angels, are actually associated with a special class of angels who fell at the time of the flood or just before the flood. In 2 Peter chapter 2, in verse 4, it says, "If God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them to pits of darkness reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a preacher of righteousness, with seven others, when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly." And he continues on, but I'm just stopping right there. It's interesting to note that he talks about these angels who fell and were condemned by God, and then he mentions the flood. Now you may say to yourself, well, that doesn't sound like a lot of reason to bring up the fact that this might be a different class of angels, fallen angels. Well, the reason why this is actually relevant and significant is because there was a very, very thick ether of tradition, Jewish tradition, at the time of the writing of the Bible, the New Testament, that argued and taught that there were a special class of angels who fell in connection with the flood. There are many writings that allude to this, that speak to this. There's the book of Enoch, which is a pseudepigraphal book. It is a non-canonical book, but it speaks of the antediluvian angels who were condemned by God and were judged by Him in connection with the wickedness that preceded the deluge. Now, this is the stuff I'm going to talk about next week. I'm not getting into it this morning, but I'm mentioning it here as a bookmark to say that this is a question that does arise from the text. But let me say this. Whether these angels are special angels who were subjected to a special curse and a special bondage that is unique from the angels who fell with Lucifer or not you still have the same lesson that we come to when we come to the main clause of verse 6. So in other words, I would argue that one way or the other, the moral lesson that we learn and the theological lesson that we learn, it is still the same. Which brings us to the third point. What is the lesson that we learn from their rebellion? What is the lesson that we learn from their rebellion? Whoever these angels are. We're not addressing that yet. We're just raising the question. The lesson that we learn is this, is that God dealt with them swiftly and in holiness. God dealt with them swiftly and in holiness. The thing we have to understand is that verse 6, and I've got to say this, or I'm going to say it again next week. Verse 6 is not about fallen angels. Okay? The main thrust, the main focus of verse 6 is not about fallen angels. It's about the God who keeps them in bondage for judgment. That's what the central argument is. By the way, same truth is true about verse 5. We talked about this when we went through verse 5. He talks about those who were delivered from Egypt. He says that that the Lord, after saving a people out of the land of Egypt, subsequently destroyed those who did not believe. You just have to say, as we talked about last time, is this about the Israelites? Is this about the unbelievers? No, it's about the God who saved them, delivered them, and then judged those who were unbelievers. The central focus is not about the unbeliever. It's about the God who judges the unbeliever. Same thing about verse 6. Verse 6 is not about the fallen angels. Primarily, it's about God who judged them and condemned them and keeps them for the day of judgment. I got to say, we got to make sure that we let the grammar of the language of Scripture, of the Scriptures themselves, to dictate what the focus is, and that we would not impose a centrality of focus that is not there in the text. Jude wants us to think about the nature of God, the theology of God in His just judgment against the rebels who rebel against His authority. And so, this primary verb, which, by the way, it should be familiar to us. It says that God keeps them or has kept them in eternal bonds under darkness for the judgment of the great day. That same word, kept, we saw when we came to the introduction of this epistle where he says, Jude, a bondservant of Jesus Christ and brother of James, to those who are the called, beloved in God the Father, and kept for Christ Jesus. There's the word tereo, kept for Jesus, for Christ Jesus. It's talking about those who are called and chosen by God for salvation. It's fascinating. It's amazing when you think about it. Because what we really have here is a statement about the fact that God keeps those who are His, and He keeps those who are not His, who are under judgment, and He reserves a day of judgment for them. So God is keeping all things in His providence. And it's really quite a contrast of thought. Hebert says this, the situation of these angels stands in striking contrast to the assertion in verse 1 that the called are permanently kept for Jesus Christ. So the children of God, they rest in the confidence and knowledge of knowing that God keeps them forever because of His grace and His power. But the angels who were condemned, they have this promise that they're going to be judged in the great day of judgment. He keeps them both. And so what's the lesson here? Again, we're going to get into more particulars about what this verse is saying, what it's not saying, what some of the other related statements of this epistle and 2 Peter have to say about who these angels are, all those controversial issues we're going to go through next time. But I want to make sure that we are grounded in the ultimate lesson that this verse is giving us. And this verse is telling us about the nature of the God who judges rebellion. And the thing that we need to understand is that Jude is mentioning fallen angels so that we would consider the fact that he is speaking to the reality of the apostates, so that we would understand that those who are apostates and who do rebel against the truth of God, what must they understand? They must understand this about God. He condemns and judges rebellion. It's true of the angels, it's true of the unbelieving within the nation of Israel, and it's true for anybody. It's a universal truth that Jude wants us to understand. And here's why. Number one, God condemns rebellion and evil, the evil of rebellion. Remember that rebellion is called the sin of witchcraft, or it is as the sin of witchcraft. God condemns it because it is evil and because He is holy. We read in our scripture reading this morning in Psalm 5, David says, as he was crying out to God and he was looking for solace and comfort and peace amidst a world of evil, he says, "For you are not a God who takes pleasure in wickedness. No evil dwells with you. The boastful shall not stand before your eyes. You hate all who do iniquity." Well, this is certainly clear in the case of Lucifer, whereby he was found with evil in his heart. The evil of pride was found within him. The unrighteousness and wickedness of self-exaltation was found within his heart. And immediately, he was cast out of heaven. Jesus said that he was watching Satan fall from heaven like lightning. That's how immediately he was ejected from heaven. As soon as unrighteousness was found in him, it was over. That's the first lesson that we understand. God is holy. He does not abide with wickedness. He does not abide with evil. And as soon as rebellion and arrogance was found in the heart of Lucifer, like lightning, it was over. God is holy and He judges rebellion quickly. Secondly, we glean from this the danger, the lesson that it is dangerous to test God. It is dangerous to test God. That's what these apostates were doing. Remember the question that was raised by Paul as we talked about it the last several weeks? Romans chapter 6, what shall we say then? Are we to continue in sin that grace may increase? Paul says, may it never be. But these practitioners of licentiousness who were turning the grace of God into licentiousness, their answer would be, oh yes. Oh yes, let's just let grace be so gracious that we can live however we want to and live in a state of rebellion against the will and plan of God. These apostates were glad to test God. They were glad to oppose Him and His will. Paul said to this idea of testing God, he says, may it never be. How shall we who died to sin still live in it? But these rebels, their answer is yes. Let's live as we wish. Let's pursue what we desire. Let's pursue the life that we desire, as we talked about in the first hour. This is really going to be the continued message, sadly, of people like Oprah and Rob Bell. Let's live the life that we desire rather than living so as to please God. Listen, the one who claims to be a disciple of Christ must take God seriously. God hates evil. He hates rebellion. He does not give grace. He does not give saving grace so that we would go on living in sin. But rather, the true child of God, if they've really been affected by grace, they're not going to be perfect people, but their lives are going to be changing and growing and maturing. But this was not the case of these apostates. We need to be careful not to test God. But we need to take Him at His word. Thirdly, there's the danger of arrogance. The danger of arrogance. Lucifer said in his heart, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. Pride goeth before the fall. We have to understand something about this issue of the original fall of Lucifer, the origin of his fall. We see that in Lucifer was a heart of pride and arrogance. He thought highly of himself, and he did not think highly of the Most High. I would suggest to you that there is an implied lesson in this, in that these apostates, they were willing to place themselves above the authority of God. Whenever a man does that, what is he doing? He's exalting himself above the Most High. He has a better idea, a better authority to which he can go to and to which he can go and consult. Charles Bigg, in his commentary, the critical and exegetical commentary on 2 Peter and Jude, suggests that Peter mentioned the fallen angels as a way of warning the arrogant false teachers of his day. And he says this, and I quote, that some of the false teachers were men of considerable eminence, very popular, very persuasive in the community of God's people. So Hebert, adding to this, says this, if this is so, Peter is giving prior notice that their position in man's eyes will not save them any more than the glory of the sinning angels saved them. Or if I could put it in this way, these terms, popularity can never sanctify bad doctrine. Popularity can never sanctify bad doctrine. These men were heretics, false teachers, and who cares how popular they were? Who cares how much eminence they possessed? Who cares how much of a following they had, like Diotrephes, and he had a following? None of that sanctifies their error. And no man should assume that just because he has a following or some popularity whatsoever, that that can somehow sanctify his heresies, his false teaching. Fourthly, verse 6 of Jude helps us to understand something about the permanence of God's judgment. How are these angels kept? In eternal bonds. How are they kept? The verb is a perfect verb, which means that God has already accomplished this work of securing them and putting them in bondage, and that perfect verb then also bears the idea of a continuation. So it's a completed historical event that continues and continues and continues on until what? The day of judgment, the great day of judgment. What is that all saying? It's all speaking of the finality of God's judgment. As a lesson for us, we have to understand when God judges, that's it. This whole idea of Rob Bell teaching and C.S. Lewis and George MacDonald talking about some sort of an idea of the fact that you can die and then go to purgatory and then get a second chance, purgatorial reconciliation. You know, if that were taught in Scripture, that'd be one thing. But I keep coming across these verses that speak of permanence of judgment. And there's no second chance theology here, especially here in verse 6. I tortured my children recently by having us watch the movie Noah, this new movie Noah. And I warned them and I told them, you know, guys, I'm going to watch this because as we're going through Jude, I know that they're going to be portraying some things that some people believe are alluded to here in Jude, 2 Peter. We'll talk about those things next week. But there's a scene where there are these fallen angels who are cohabitating with mankind prior to the flood. And forgive me, but the movie's really... If you get a chance to see it, don't. Save your money, save your time. As a pastor, I felt the need to just watch it so I could know what's in the movie so I could address it, but I'm done with it. And I'm going to tell you, if I could get a refund, I would do it. I don't think I'm going to get a refund, but really poorly executed, very, very untethered to Scripture. But they place in this scene and throughout the movie this idea of fallen angels who basically became like rock monsters. They were covered in lava. They became like looking like rock monsters and very odd, very peculiar. But there's a scene where they're trying to help Noah. They're helping Noah build the ark, and they're helping to protect Noah and his family. And as they're doing this and doing a good work, a good deed for mankind, what do you think happens? They start getting raptured up into heaven, one after the other after the other. They lose their rock layer, and they are ejected as a mass of light back up into heaven. Kind of like purgatorial reconciliation. They ended up meriting a return back to heaven. Now, I'm not saying that these angels are the antediluvian angels referred to in the movie, but how do you square that with what Jude says, where he says that God has kept them in eternal bonds under darkness? You cannot reconcile these two ideas. There's a permanence of judgment that is stated in verse 6 that is conflicted, it is contradicted by what the movie portrayed in terms of these angels going back up to heaven. It's a nice thought in terms of wishful thinking, but I can't square it with Scripture. That's a big problem. Finally, I would just conclude with this and say that this vision of these fallen angels, this vision should cause us all to tremble and to cling to Christ even more, because we see the permanence and the immediacy of God's judgment of Lucifer, that cherub who was created in righteousness and purity and yet he fell. I think of any sinner who would read this verse, and if they would ever be tempted to boast within themselves in the sight of fallen angels falling from heaven, the person who would do that would be an unconverted madman. Because if these angels could not keep their own domain, what hope would any man have of saving his own life and his own soul? What hope do we have but to cling to Christ and to His cross, and to cling to the grace of God and nothing else? But I got to say, we've been talking about fallen angels. We've been talking about the fact that there's even the fall of man and death through sin, right? Future glory, it's going to be different. Because I read in Revelation chapter 21, and there it says there will no longer be any death. No longer be any mourning or crying or pain. Okay? What God permitted with respect to the fall of the angels, the fall of man, as I read the Bible here in Revelation, it's not going to happen again. So I ask the question, we've had family devotions where we say, after reading Revelation 21 and verse 4, there's no longer going to be any death. So I ask my kids, is there going to be another fall? Will mankind fall from heaven somehow? Such that there will be mourning and crying and pain and the sorrow of sin and death? The answer is no. God will keep us and preserve us by His grace from those things. That's our only hope, is the grace of God. It's not found in us, but it's found solely in Him. How dependent are we on God for salvation? The word is entirely, entirely dependent. So brethren, we have much to study and examine as we continue in this verse. And next week I'm going to take you through more of the details, more of the questions, more of the controversies. I didn't want to drag all that out in this morning's message. I wanted to make sure that we understand what this text does teach about the nature of God primarily. We'll get into more of the details next time and more of the controversy and questions next time. But again, we need to be warned. It's dangerous to have flirtations with false teachers. We need to resist them. And this is the very thing that Jude is imploring the church to do. Not to have relations with them, not to be friendly with them, but to resist them and rebuke their error. Why? Because God judges such rebellion as was being produced by these apostates. And so we live as soldiers. We're not to fraternize with the enemy. We're not to make friends with the enemy. We're not to make light of their status as being at enmity with God. And so I want us to think about that very idea, that question, am I a soldier of the cross? If we're soldiers, then we're fighting on behalf of God and His truth, and we're not developing relationships with those who are the enemy. We've got to understand that. We want to make friends where we can, but we don't want to compromise truth in the process. So let's close with our time with the singing of this hymn number 439, Am I a Soldier of the Cross?